What does zero tolerance on immigration look like? This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A small group of reporters got access to a federal detention facility in Texas. It holds almost 1,500 immigrant children.
This was just them trying to say, look, kids are not being held in cages.
Also today, the history of American information warfare, as a new video from the White House about North Korea policy raises some eyebrows.
My first thought was that it was very corporate and like the sort of thing somebody would be shown if they were trying to sell you a timeshare.
And in Puerto Rico, survivors of Hurricane Maria find solace in a kitchen.
You don't need a psychologist, you don't need a therapist, you don't need nothing because we have it here.
All that and more coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Glad you could join us this Thursday. So imagine a big box store like Walmart. Nothing more American than that. Then imagine that cavernous place being converted into a detention center for immigrant children. That's what happened in Brownsville, Texas a few years ago. But now there are some 1,400 boys there between the ages of 10 and 17 being held after they crossed the border without documentation. Aaron Nelson of the San Antonio Express News was one of a small group of reporters allowed inside the facility yesterday.
I think the reason that we were having this walkthrough was to dispel some of the rumors that kids were being held in cages. The Casa Padre management and executives who were there made that pretty clear. It was, in my view, a very nice facility. It looked something like how I might describe a charter school. When you first walked in, there was a cafeteria, pretty nice kitchen. There were brightly colored murals painted all over the walls. In other areas, there was a barber shop. There were indoor and outdoor basketball courts, pool tables, kids playing video games on big screen TVs. There was a movie theater playing Moana in Spanish. There were classrooms. There was a medical area. Overall, the eyeball test, it was a nice facility.
I don't know whether you've ever visited a low-security prison, but how would it compare to that?
I've been to some immigrant detention facilities for adults. Immigrants that are inside are wearing basically prison uniforms. There's fencing and everywhere. This place was really nothing like that. The facade of it is of a school for kids.
Do the kids get outside much?
They get out for 2 hours in the day. They have an hour of physical education, which is structured, and then they have an hour of unstructured play. They have a couple of soccer fields and a basketball court outside. But I need to emphasize, this is all just what it looked like.
Right.
I have no idea, nor were we given the opportunity to discuss with kids what's going on in their heads, whether they were suffering from some type of anxiety, being separated from family. It's one thing what the facility looks like. It's another thing entirely what these kids are going through and, you know, what's going on in their heads.
I was going to ask you, what was the extent of your interactions with those kids?
I mean, it was a little bit like walking through some kind of an exhibit. You know, we're all staring at each other. They're staring at us as we're staring at them. Some of the kids are kind of giggling, amused at the gringo reporters as they're walking through. You know, it was kind of hard to tell if any particular kid was distraught.
Now, many of these kids were forcibly separated from their parents or relatives. What happened to them before they arrived at this detention center?
There are a certain number of kids who are or were separated from their parent when they crossed the border, but they didn't really give us like what the ratio. They made it sound like that was a minor part of the population that they had at Casa Padre. Casa Padre says that it has clinicians and it has caseworkers and it has everything that the children need. But at the same time, you know, there are violations occasionally. I mean, in fact, my colleague, Ali Morris, wrote a story over the weekend about Southwest Key and the violations that they've had at their facilities across Texas. This one even had some violations, 13 in the last year. One of them, a child, was tested positive for a sexually transmitted disease, but wasn't given treatment for more than 2 weeks. We didn't have the opportunity to really pry into those things and how they were being addressed.
Is there a plan for reuniting the boys you saw with their parents?
I have some questions about the actual success rate of locating parents. I have been in the federal court in McAllen where a parent, after several days of being detained, stands in front of a federal judge and says, I don't know where my kid is. But the shelter staff claims that they managed to contact every parent. And at the same time, they contact a sponsor. Typically, they want the sponsor to be a family member living legally someplace in the United States. So whether or not the child is reunited with a parent or not really depends on – it's a kind of a case-by-case situation, I think. And I think it also depends on the desire of the parent. I would imagine that in some of these situations where a child is being separated from a parent at the border, the parent might be in deportation proceedings and might want their kid to go home with them. But if they have a family member living someplace in the United States, they might also decide, I would prefer for my son or daughter to go live with you in Houston or Washington, D.C.
Aaron Nelson, their bureau chief for the San Antonio Express News, is speaking with us from McAllen, Texas. U.S. immigration policy is definitely part of the conversation at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops this week. The bishops are gathered in Florida for their spring meeting, and there's been some sharp language on the issue. The Archbishop of Galveston, Houston, said that the Trump administration's zero-tolerance immigration policy is immoral. Another bishop suggested holding prayer vigils outside of federal courthouses to protest the Trump administration's policies. Cardinal Joseph Tobin of New Jersey is at the conference in Fort Lauderdale. Cardinal, immigration policy in this country has concerned a lot of religious leaders from different faiths. The Pope has spoken about it. Tell us what the atmosphere was like in the room yesterday.
Well, I think that there was a real point of convergence among, you know, bishops who respectfully disagree on a lot of stuff. But I think over the last couple of years, there's been a growing consensus on the immorality and a real concern for the spiritual, emotional welfare of the people of the United States.
Did that start before Donald Trump came to office? I mean, was there one moment that led to this greater sense of urgency?
Well, I think we were aware and actually had some disputes with the prior administration on some of their immigration policies, and then a wider concern with the absolute paralysis of the United States Congress to, you know, enact a realistic reform of immigration legislation. I mean, I don't think anybody's defending a broken system. What we really are against is victimizing people who really don't have a way out.
Now, bishops who speak about immigration and asylum frequently talk about the right to life, which sounds similar to the argument against abortion. So just to be clear on the rhetoric, can you explain what you mean by right to life when it pertains to immigration?
Well, I think probably the more common phrasing is human dignity. One of the most essential acts of recognizing human dignity is to recognize that somebody's got a right to live. Mm. But I think human dignity is often the way, Marco, that it's framed. And there are a number of us who really advocate a consistent ethic of life in people for whom sometimes that dignity is not seen or is taken away.
So as far as taking action, at the conference yesterday, you proposed sending a group of bishops to the border to inspect detention facilities. Is that going to happen? And what's your goal with that?
Well, I believe it's going to happen. I mean, I'll go myself. I think it would be more powerful if it wasn't the Joe Tobin show, you know, that this is a moral imperative that's felt by a number of us. You know, I made my suggestion and I'm going to stick to it.
And what would be the goal? What would you actually do there? Or whoever goes?
Well, I think what we want to do is first ensure the physical safety of the children who have been separated from their families. And if we're permitted to, you know, say, look, you're not alone. We're working to reunite you with your family. And I would tell them probably that I'm the oldest of a big family and I might have some idea how they're suffering.
I've seen that New Mexico's Bishop Oscar Cantu suggested public gestures such as prayer vigils in front of federal courthouses, and Arizona's Bishop Edward Weisenberger proposed canonical penalties for Catholics involved with separating families at the border. Are we going to see Catholic leaders testing out strategies like this in the next few weeks?
Well, I think some of them have already happened. I mean, about 4 weeks ago, I joined with a number of faith groups in a effort sponsored by the American Friends Service Committee, the Quakers, to pray before the federal building in Newark. In fact, we call it the Jericho Walk, hoping that just as Joshua walked 7 times around the walls of Jericho, the wall of intolerance and persecution will fall. I'm meeting in September with the Faith Leaders of New Jersey, which is an interreligious group, Jewish, Muslim, as well as Christian, Hindu, Sikh. And this will be on our agenda. There's a number of different coalitions that are operating, and I think we're all concerned, you know.
When it comes to faith, Cardinal, what would you tell Donald Trump about what you see as wrong with immigration in this country, and specifically what's happening along the border?
Well, I think we'd have to first see if we could talk on common ground of faith. I would say if he wants to just talk rationally, we can talk about the evidence for the dignity of human beings. But from a faith perspective, I point out in the Judeo-Christian tradition a consistent imperative to welcome the stranger and to care for the helpless. I would talk about compassion. And I guess I would have to hear a little bit from my partner in dialogue just what he believes. And I would search with him for common ground.
Evangelicals are an important part of Donald Trump's base. Do you think they hear those messages that you're just talking about?
There was big headlines this morning, Marco. I'm sure you saw them, that Franklin Graham came out with a very strong condemnation of the new policy of separating children from their families. So, yeah, there's common ground with evangelicals.
I mean, the immigration issue seems to be cracking the faith of Catholics who supported Trump in the past, and perhaps those cracks are also showing among evangelicals. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think that the practices are built on a narrative of fear. Fear is a very powerful motivator. I think it's imperative for people of faith to put a face on the immigrants, to help reduce the opprobrium that can be heaped on people who are simply perceived as being other. And say, you know, these are human beings. These are grandparents. These are grandkids. These are folks like my own grandparents who are coming to this country in the hope of a better life, or sometimes simply fleeing persecution and violence that would take their lives. I think we're all concerned, you know, and one of our hopes is to convince the members of Congress to act, and to act in a humane way that is consistent with the best traditions of this country.
Cardinal Joseph Tobin of New Jersey speaking with us from the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops in Fort Lauderdale. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
Across Great Britain today, people stood in silence for 72 seconds, 1 second for each of the 72 people who died in the Grenfell Tower fire in London exactly 1 year ago. Here in Boston, I was transfixed by a Sky News clip showing a crowd gathered near the tower.
They're, of course, all wearing green, that color which has been adopted by many of the campaign groups in the local community to remember those 72 people who died in the fire.
One of the most powerful moments shows a train stopping overhead on a bridge, blowing its horn in honor of the dead. And then,
in the center of London, actually, the tube driver there holding a green banner, being met with applause there.
The driver of the train opened the door to the first car and held up that green banner to the crowd below. Meantime, at a memorial service today inside St. Helen's Church in West London, very close to Grenfell Tower itself,
Siriash Shukane, Nadia Shukane.
Names of the 72 victims were read aloud. Large families perished in the blaze.
Myanna Shukane, Zainab Shukane.
And understandably, there continues to be anger. MP David Lammy spoke at the service.
Never, ever, ever again can people die in a preventable fire.
After the service at St. Helens, there was a sense among people who attended that the speakers helped the healing process, but also united the survivors.
It's compassionate. It was real. I hope it continues to heal the hearts of the people in the area.
There's also this song that was composed by two survivors of the fire and has been getting a lot of attention in London this week. It's performed by two girls who go by the names Yusra and Johara. The video begins quietly with a girl looking at a picture of a friend whom she is missing. The memory is too painful, and she rolls over and goes back to sleep.
You're always in my thoughts, yeah, you're always in my mind. I wish that you were still here, oh, why did you have to die? Why did they care about money before my best friend's life? So come on, come on, come on, come on, you had the words to change.
The song simply titled Fire in Grenfell. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Let me play something for you. You're going to guess where it comes from. It's a bit long, so sit back and enjoy.
It comes down to a choice. On this day, In this time, at this moment, the world will be watching, listening, anticipating, hoping. Will this leader choose to advance his country and be part of a new world? Be the hero of his people? Will he shake the hand of peace and enjoy prosperity like he has never seen? A great life or more isolation? Which path will be chosen?
All right, what do you think? If you said reality TV show, you're wrong. Movie trailer? Nope. An act of diplomacy? Let's hear the rest.
Featuring President Donald Trump and Chairman Kim Jong-un in a meeting to remake history, to shine in the sun. One moment, one choice. What if? The future remains to be written.
I feel compelled to say coming soon to a theater near you. But yeah, this is actually part of a video designed to look like a movie trailer and is prepared by the National Security Council for an audience of one man, the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Donald Trump showed this video to him on his iPad at the summit in Singapore. When it was shown to journalists, some assumed it was a North Korean propaganda video. It was, in fact, a riff on Spike Lee, a White House joint. Nick Cole has written extensively on U.S. information warfare. He's a professor of public diplomacy at the University of Southern California. Professor Cole, what did you make of this NSC video?
Well, I was surprised by it because it was just so bizarre. But my final thought about it really is that it wasn't meant to persuade me. It was meant to persuade Kim Jong-un, and I guess in the long run will be judged by whether or not he was impressed by it or amused by it or whatever the effect they were going for.
Just in terms of the style, the film critic for the New York Times called it totalitarian kitsch. How would you characterize it, and why did you see it as bizarre?
My first thought was that it was very corporate and like the sort of thing somebody would be shown if they were trying to sell you a timeshare, or like the kind of welcome video that you see when you go into a World's Fair pavilion. But I thought it was very strange to see North Korean propaganda material edited together with news footage and also some bits and pieces that were borrowed from, well, basically from peace movies, the idea of rolling film backwards so that the weapons return to, you know, the missiles come into land. You know, that's borrowed from Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-5, where he imagines a movie where the bombs fly up into the bays of aircraft and are taken back and sort of the whole war is undone.
The tape actually reminded me of this famous political ad from LBJ in the 1964 presidential election.
Six, eight, nine. These are the stakes.
So this is not from the U.S. Information Agency. It's a pretty powerful image there, basically saying a vote for LBJ's opponent, Barry Goldwater, is a vote for nuclear war. Right. Barry Goldwater lost to Lyndon Johnson in 64. Who knows how much that had to do with the ad. But it leaves me wondering, Nick, what are we supposed to do with this dramatic propaganda? On one hand, a lot of it is cheesy and campy, almost humorous. And for 2018, the White House video feels kind of stuck in the 50s. Are there examples of this campy stuff that has led to a path to peace or progress?
Well, that's a good question. And, you know, as I said at the opening, I don't think we should judge this based on our reaction to it, that it wasn't meant for us. And the proof of whether or not this was a worthwhile thing will be in the reaction of Kim Jong-un and the people around him. There are examples of films being used in talks before. In 1983, USIA did a short film about the shooting down of the Korean airliner, and they showed it in the UN, and that really embarrassed the Russians and helped to consolidate opinion against what had happened in the UN General Assembly. And the second example would be when Saddam had invaded Kuwait and the US deployed allied troops to Saudi Arabia, they created a film about the strength of the allied force called A Line in the Sand. And that film, also for an audience of one, was presented to the Iraqi ambassador so that Saddam could see and would understand how strong the United States and its allies were and would hopefully come in to negotiate. Now, that
film, which was very restrained, very matter of fact, that failed because obviously he didn't come in to negotiate. So, you know, it's not unprecedented to have films figuring in negotiations or in diplomatic situations, but we can't really judge them. It's such a special context that we can't judge them on their aesthetic merits. We have to think about, well, how do they play out diplomatically? Does it help the situation or does it hurt? And with the North Korean negotiation, it's too early to tell, but it's possible that it broke the ice and was a thing that helped the two men bond with one another.
So what kind of history does the U.S. have with making propaganda films?
Well, the U.S. government has been using film as a way of communicating in foreign policy and international relations as long as the technology has been available. But I think it was in the Cold War that this really became something that was perfected. There was this agency, the United States Information Agency, whose job was explaining America to international audiences. And their film unit was so good, they won Oscars in the documentary film category.
Mm. You have an example of a good propaganda movie from this golden age of the USIA?
You know, we shouldn't use propaganda in a pejorative way. I think you need to think about it just as something that's designed to persuade people on a political subject. And if you're talking about that, there was a great film made by Bruce Hershenson as an obituary for President Kennedy, Years of Lightning, Day of Drums. It was just an amazing feature-length production that meant a lot to people who saw it. But I think that now one of the most impressive things they did in retrospect was a film about the March on Washington made by a filmmaker called James Blue. It really captures the reactions of the audience on that day. And the climax of the film, of course, is Dr. King's speech.
We actually have an excerpt from that film. Let's hear it.
August 28th, 1963, 200,000 Americans came to Washington to demand complete freedom for everyone. This is the story of that day.
I mean, I do know this one. It's a beautiful film to boot. Why did this one work in terms of propaganda?
Because, first of all, it was something that people wanted to know about, and it was an amazing piece of visual art. It put the viewer right in the middle of the march and communicated the spirit of a very impressive event. And so what was happening here was that the United States was not putting a gloss on something, rather it was opening up an aspect of the American experience. So it's maybe better to think about this as being an act of diplomacy or sharing or exchange as much as something crude like propaganda. And I think that where the United States was able to use film as a way of sharing the American experience, it worked very well.
It is fascinating stuff. Nick Kull, professor of public diplomacy at the University of Southern California and the author of The Decline and Fall of the United States Information Agency. Thanks very much, Nick.
Oh, thanks, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, World Cup fever starts with the language of soccer. Like, why do Brazilians refer to one particular move as a cow dribble?
When amateur footballers were playing games on bits of scrubland and farmland, you having to circumnavigate passing bovines was an occupational hazard.
That story just ahead, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. World Cup 2018 is underway in Russia. The tournament kicked off with a match between host Russia and Saudi Arabia. Reporter Charles Maines caught the game at a bar in Moscow. We spoke with him earlier today.
I'm just at a pub in central Moscow. Of course, the city's out to watch the Russian squad play against Saudi Arabia today. And, you know, everyone's excited and it's pretty jamming here.
Now, it's not too noisy there in the pub, but I want your full attention. So can you get to a slightly quieter place?
Yeah. Just give me a second. One second.
Okay.
How's that, Marco?
Yeah, very good. So we just want to take this moment on the first day to set up the political frame for this edition of the World Cup, because the World Cup's always more than just soccer. What is Vladimir Putin hoping to show the world by hosting this?
Well, this has always been a personal project of Vladimir Putin's. Sport has been a key part of his rule over the last 18 years. Of course, the big moment starting with the Sochi Olympics in 2014. They've hosted the Confederation Cup and, of course, now this World Cup. And it's just part of this notion that Russia has risen from the backward 90s, from the chaos of not being able to kind of handle big sporting events and being frankly ignored on the world stage is something where they feel like they're taken seriously.
And do you think the stakes are higher for the 2018 World Cup, more so than the 2014 Sochi Olympics? Like, what's changed in those 4 years?
Well, they're different. Sochi was about Russia's sort of return to Soviet glory in sport. I think there's not a sense that the Russian squad has a chance of winning this World Cup. At the same time, I think what's really interesting is you go back to some of the criticisms around Russia hosting these big events, and human rights defenders talk about a lot of the same stuff now as then. I mean, if it's political repressions or pressure against LGBT groups, it's pretty much the same story. What's interesting, though, is that human rights defenders will say the situation's just gotten worse over the last 4 years. If you recall, even back from Sochi, you know, at that point, Vladimir Putin was still willing to listen to foreign criticism, particularly Western criticism over Russia's human rights record. He made a bunch of grand gestures ahead of the Sochi Games, if you remember, for example, releasing high-profile political prisoners, people like the members of Pussy Riot or the Greenpeace activists who were imprisoned ahead of the Sochi Games for protesting Russia's drilling of oil in the Arctic. And these were gestures really for the foreign audience, not so much for Russians at home. This time, we're not really seeing any of that. If anything, I would say it's almost doubling down. You look at, for example, some of the decisions, never mind the FIFA guidelines, this is the World Soccer Governing Body, that says that you know, human rights and tolerance and anti-discrimination should be part of the games. You know, we have the Republic of Chechnya hosting the Egyptian squad for its training ground. This is where Ramzan Kadyrov, the head of Chechnya, recently carried out essentially pogroms against gays in his region. He denies that, but the evidence is pretty clear. And it's very strange then to see one of the world's most popular soccer stars, Mo Salah from Egypt, their star forward, being dragged out from his hotel to basically do a PR op with Ramzan Kadyrov.
So in the past, Putin seemed willing to make some gestures to the international community and critics. This time, not so much. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's a little bit of Russia following 2014, the annexation of Crimea and all the political events that have followed, whether we're talking about Western sanctions because of Crimea and also Russia's intrusion into East Ukraine, whether we're talking about related sanctions relative to Russian interference in elections, whether we're talking about the doping scandal that came in the wake of Russia's hosting the Sochi Olympics. You know, all these stories and more, including Syria, I mean, all of them have basically amounted to Russia feeling that it's under the gun all the time, that it's guilty of everything, as they say. And, you know, the sense is they just, they're so used to it now, they're kind of inured to it. They just don't care anymore.
So will Russians just be able to sit back and enjoy sport for the next 3 weeks, or will all of this stuff be kind of rattling around their brains?
Well, I think a lot of it depends, first of all, on how the Russian squad does tonight.
Yeah,
that's one, because there's a lot of hand-wringing here that the Russian squad might not make it out of the initial group round, and that all this money, $14 billion spent on hosting these games, will have all been for naught.
Charles Maines, we'll leave it there. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Charles Maines there in Moscow speaking with us earlier today. So how did the Russians do? All right, spoiler alert, if you don't already know and want to catch the game later, block your ears right now. Final score on that game was Russia 5, Saudi 0. For many fans, this is a moment to relish, to put politics aside and just get totally tribal. Let's not forget, the World Cup is the biggest tournament of the world's most popular sport. So, yeah, embrace the tribalism. Patrick Cox is a big soccer fan. He also hosts our podcast on language, The World in Words.
And you know what? There is a ton to talk about when it comes to soccer and language. I've always known that so many of the words and phrases that we use to describe, you know, soccer skills and moves and stuff, they come from other languages. And that's why I wanted to talk to Tom Williams. He's compiled a glossary of soccer terminology in as many languages as he could find out about. So let me play you a bit of my conversation with Tom. He speaks French, and it was that that got him thinking about the role that French and other languages, the role they play in our understanding of the game.
there is a really straightforward football skill, soccer skill, that has no name in English, and it's when a player gets the ball, he has an opponent running towards him, so he knocks the ball past the opponent on one side and then runs around the other side to collect it.
Oh, yeah.
You see,
I've tried
almost,
and failed many times to do that.
You see it in almost every football match you ever watch, and in French they call it un grand pont, a big bridge, and it's the sister term of their name for a nutmeg when you push the ball between an opponent's legs, which is known as a petit pont, a little bridge. And then I found that there were terms for this skill move in other languages. So in Spanish, it's an autopass, like a self-pass, which is pretty self-explanatory. Mm. In Brazil, in Brazilian Portuguese, they call it a drible de vaca, which means a cow dribble. And the story there is supposedly that when amateur footballers were playing games on bits of scrubland and farmland, you having to circumnavigate passing bovines was an occupational hazard. And so that's the thinking behind where that term comes from. And we don't have a name for that in English. So I think that informed the desire to write about the language of football, both just to celebrate it and also to use it to draw attention to all these, you know, skill moves and technical elements to the game that we've never really got round to naming in English.
Makes you realize that English isn't the be-all and end-all of this. Our glossary is incomplete.
Yes, there's a sense that in Britain, as the inventors of modern football, if you like, as the country that codified the sport and exported it around the world, we didn't see the need to give names to various elements of the sport. So the linguistic building blocks of football, if you like, remain British in origin. Football itself, soccer even, which is a corruption of association football, goal, offside, referee, free kick, penalty. And these words are used all around the world, the basic terminology of football, if you like. But then the slightly more elaborate language to do with skill moves, particularly. These were things that had to be invented somewhere else because it was other countries that played the sport with the requisite level of technical artistry, if you like, that enabled new skills to be invented. And as a result, we have these loan words in the English language. I mean, Rabona, which comes from Argentinian football, is the skill whereby a player wraps his kicking foot behind his standing foot to kick the ball. And that's something that is quite widely referred to as Rabona in multiple different football countries. And that's why Rabona is now adopted by people speaking about football in English.
What is up, people? PWG here. And a lot of you guys have been asking for a Rabona tutorial. Today's your lucky day.
So a Rabona, kind of a blind back pass. You ever tried one of those, Patrick?
I have made a fool of myself in many ways on the soccer field, but not that particular way.
Okay. So those are soccer skills. Really fascinating. What about other situations on the field, like a super fast counterattack or a team that only wants to defend?
Oh, a team that only wants to defend. Now, that actually got coined by a Portuguese coach, José Mourinho. He described that as parking the bus.
Not going anywhere.
There is a fantastic variety of ways that you can describe, for example, chaos on the soccer field. Like when a defense is overrun, they've lost all semblance of organization. So in British English, we actually borrow an American term that I don't think you use in sports.
What
we
is
say
it?
It's all Keystone Cops.
Huh. No, we don't use that in sports. I do use it some other ways, but not in sports.
And then the Portuguese, they'll call the same thing, this sort of defensive chaos, and please pardon my pronunciation here, andar aos papéis, which means walking on papers.
Huh.
Don't know why.
Yeah.
The Dutch, they say something completely unpronounceable that I'm not even going to try, but it means women and children first.
The boat's sinking, women and children first.
Something like that. The best one, you tell me if you understand why this could possibly be the case.
Okay.
It's Norwegian, and they describe this defensive chaos as Hawaii football.
Hawaii football.
Yep.
Hawaii 5-0, big waves crashing. I don't know. But yeah.
Volcanoes.
It evokes something for them. You know, all of this, Patrick, especially that cow dribble from Brazil, it reminds me of the joy I have just watching soccer games in languages other than English.
Yeah, yeah. Tom Williams and I talked about that too. Here he is again.
I mean, there's a lot to be said for watching football matches in the original commentary, even if you don't understand the language, just to get a sense of what those games sound like when they're watched in a different country. And I think also something that the internet and social media in particular has helped to do is to open people's ears to different forms of commentary from around the world. I mean, I'm thinking now when Egypt qualified for the World Cup, Mo Salah scored this impossibly dramatic penalty deep into stoppage time of their final qualifying match. And the Egyptian commentator, while he was calling the goal, actually broke down in tears.
Allah! 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 Allah!
And as he's sobbing into his microphone, the camera is panning around the stadium. And you realise that half the people there are in tears because Egypt have waited since 1990 to reach a World Cup. And they've finally done it in this heart-stopping fashion. So I suspect, thanks to social media, that if we do get any, you know, particularly memorable moments in the commentary on a game, even if it's not in English, that that'll be something that will be shared and that people get an opportunity to watch.
Wow, that emotion from that Egyptian commentator, that is the quintessence of the World Cup. Tom Williams there, and he's written a book, right, Patrick?
Yep, the book is called Do You Speak Football? A Glossary of Words and Phrases from Around the World.
All right, and I have to ask, Patrick, who are you rooting for in this year's World Cup? It's got to be England, right?
I think I'm going to sidestep that question. I'm going to say I'm rooting for good, interesting stories to come out of this World Cup. And actually, there is one involving England. In my nerdy language world, at least, it counts as a good story. So the three Russian cities holding England games in the group stage of the World Cup are Volgograd, Nizhny Novgorod, and Kaliningrad, if I've got those pronunciations correct.
Sounds pretty good.
Guess what they have in common, apart from being Russian?
What do they have in common?
Until quite recently, they all had different names. So Volgograd used to be Stalingrad. It was changed after a few years after Joseph Stalin died. Nizhny Novgorod also had a communist-era name. It was called Gorky, after the Russian writer Maxim Gorky. And Kaliningrad, it used to be a German city called Königsberg until the end of the Second World War when the Soviet troops took it over, and it's been Russian ever since.
I mean, that really speaks volumes, doesn't it, about Russian history and just the tumult over the years in that part of the world.
Indeed.
Very skillful sidestepping of the question, or as the French would say, a petit pont. Patrick Cox hosts our podcast, The World in Words. Thanks a lot for this, Patrick. It was really fascinating.
You're welcome, Marco.
Altogether, 11 Russian cities will be hosting World Cup games, from Kaliningrad on the Baltic Sea to Samara on the Volga River. Another host city on the Volga is Kazan. It's about 500 miles east of Moscow. It's the capital of the Russian Republic of Tatarstan. And it's also the hometown of one of my colleagues at the BBC's Russian service, Olga Ivshina.
I recently visited my hometown and saw the preparations, for the World Cup. And Kazan is a very nice and welcoming city at all times. But now you feel that, you know, they're trying their best and they're preparing. You can see banners all over the place and stadium is radiant, shining. And ordinary people prepare as well. I heard school kids and grown-ups trying to learn English. We usually have all road signs, street signs in two languages, in Russian and in Tatar, and now they added a third line in English. So you really do feel like in a multicultural city straight on. I also know that some of my friends who have restaurants prepare as well there. For example, a friend of mine who has his own Tatar national restaurant, he prepares special set of menus for Muslim fans because Kazan would host Iranian team. So they prepare, you know, special areas where Muslim fans can come, go to the mosque, then eat halal food, and then see all the matches and share, you know, this holiday with other fans. I think it's important that Kazan is hosting World Cup because it's both a challenge and an opportunity. I won't say that everything is ideal. You know, Kazan is facing some challenges which are typical for Russia, for example, some pressure on local opposition or some troubles with social care, etc., etc. So then people say, why are we spending so much money on preparation for the World Cup, even though we have more urgent problems to tackle? But I guess it helps Kazan to become better, because when it will be in the spotlight of the media, in spotlight of the local and international media, I hope this will help city to improve for guests, but also to make the city itself better for people who live there constantly.
The BBC's Olga Ivshina talking about her hometown, Kazan, and Tatarstan. The city is hosting its first World Cup game on Saturday between France and Australia. A big thanks to the BBC's Fifth Floor podcast for Olga's story. The Kilauea volcano in Hawaii just keeps blasting away. A new eruption there yesterday produced a magnitude 5.4 earthquake. The volcano has led to mass evacuations and has destroyed more than 600 homes since it began erupting on May 3rd. But so far, the direct human toll has been minimal. Not so in Guatemala. An eruption of that country's Fuego volcano on June 4th killed dozens of people and injured many more. Some of the young victims were so badly injured that they were flown out of the country to be treated at the Shriners Hospital for Children in Galveston, Texas. Dr. Raymond Zapata is a surgeon there. He says he's seen some very serious cases.
Six very critical patients with more than 30% total body surface area burn. And they receive skin graft until we cover all the areas. Like, for example, a 30% burn will take 30 days. If there is bigger, 40, 50%, we're talking 40, 50 days.
Wow.
And some of the patients had inhalation injury due to the inhalation of some of the materials in the air at very high temperature. The lungs are inflamed. They produce a lot of secretion, and this can lead to infections like pneumonia. So these patients are in respirators, and they will get better with time.
I read that all these injuries were life-threatening when the kids arrived last week, and they were in really bad shape. What is their condition now, about a week later?
They're stable right now, but they're very critical. The recovery from the burns itself would take like 1 or 2 years. And they need a lot of treatment. They need rehab for years. And also they need a lot of plastic surgery, recon surgeries to improve the function, mobility with hands, arms, face. And they always come with one parent so they can be with them through the whole procedure and they can help them to recuperate also. So they will take a long time to get these patients back to normal in the society.
So you said these kids aren't ventilators. I don't suppose they've been able to even speak yet about what happened.
No, no. At the moment, we don't have any particular information. Four are really very critical and two are in a better shape. But right now they're being treated. Probably in a few weeks, we'll have details of each case and what happened to each one.
I mean, as traumatic as these injuries are, you sound pretty confident that these kids eventually will be back to normal.
Yeah, the mortality here is the best of the world. There is almost no mortality with cases of 80, 90% total body surface area burn. This kid will die in some other country because there's very expensive burns. So this is one of the best places to recuperate.
Will Shriners Hospital there in Galveston be treating more victims of the Guatemala volcano eruption?
At the moment, we don't have any other information, but if they need our help, we're open to get more patients.
Dr. Raymond Zapata, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Raymond Zapata is a surgeon at the Shriners Hospital for Children in Galveston, Texas. When Hurricane Maria tore across Puerto Rico last fall, it left a path of destruction and death, and also depression. And in the tiny town of Mariana, in the eastern part of the U.S. territory, some residents looked for comfort in a kitchen, and they found it. Irina Zhorov of station WHYY has that story.
Mathilde Colon rode out the storm with family. On the morning after Hurricane Maria, she learned that the winds had destroyed her wooden house.
Y cuando subí, ay Dios mío.
When she went to see it, her world fell apart.
La nevera por un lado.
The fridge over here.
La estufa por otro lado.
The stove over there.
Camas baratas.
The beds and bureaus wrecked.
Bueno, todo, todo, todo. Yo quedé sin nada.
She lost everything. She moved in with her son in a little town about a half hour from her home. And she became really, really depressed. She says she went to see a psychologist. Then she met some other women in a similar situation.
We all live by ourselves.
I live by myself, she lives by herself.
Maria Lavoie points at the elegant women, hair done, eyebrows painted, bustling around her in a busy kitchen.
She lives by herself, she lives by herself. And she lives by herself.
They're in their 60s, 70s, 80s. Most lost something during the storm. After the hurricane, about seven of them started gathering in the town's Hilltop Community Center, which has an industrial kitchen. Usually, the kitchen is used for an annual festival. But after the storm, a group of activists turned it into a community eatery, putting the women to work serving food every day. A month after the women started cooking, the kitchen got upgraded with donated solar panels and a big battery to power it.
What is that?
Chicken. This is brother chicken.
As she weaves between the women in colorful aprons, wielding spatulas and plates, Maria stuffs some chicken in my mouth.
It's good.
Mm-hmm. You want any?
No, I have to work.
Okay.
The chicken is juicy and crunchy. Each woman has her specialty. Herman Margarita says she likes to make the beans and chickpeas and attends to people when they arrive.
Nosotros comenzamos llevándole comida a las personas encamadas.
Maria Martinez says at first they delivered the food to bedridden and sick people, like her own daughter, who broke her leg in a fall during the storm. Community members without power at home started showing up, sometimes hundreds per day, and they fed them. Then the women started feeding volunteers from the mainland, who'd arrived to help with various projects. Meals are free for the volunteers. Others pay a small fee to eat here. On this day, workers from the Salvation Army had dropped off boxes of food and diapers, so the little mountaintop was teeming with people.
Today, I could direct 2 pesos. For too many people today.
She cooked 2 batches.
We get together. Instead of being in the home lonely and by yourself and depressed, we just spend the day here. We laugh.
Maria Lavoie says they laugh, they argue, they make up.
It's nice. You don't need a psychologist, you don't need a therapist, you don't need nothing because we have it here. And it's like, this is like a therapy for us.
Maria translates what she's saying to the others. And they nod. Mathilde Colon, who lost her house, says they've become sisters. She feels good. As the lunch hour wraps up, the women spray pots clean for the next day. They're the most enthusiastic, coordinated, and efficient group of workers I've ever seen. After Maria, their sense of community is something worth singing about. For The World, I'm Irina Jorov, Mariana, Puerto Rico.
Bonding over food, I totally get it. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.